You're listening to Health First, heard across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
So Josephine, it seems to me the one thing a lot of people think of when they think about gene editing, bioethics, all of that, is they go way back and they think about a doctor named Frankenstein. Is that something that you find people keep bringing up in the discussions that you have about the bioethics of gene editing?
Well, it is something that I talked a lot about last year because it was the 200th anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein, actually. So I went to a few events that were specifically about Frankenstein and the impact of that story on science and on our conversations about science. It comes up a little bit. I mean, I think, well, you know, there's a lot to say about the book. I think it's a little bit misinterpreted, so I would encourage readers who haven't read it in a while to give it another look, because there's a lot going on in that book, and it's often held up as a cautionary tale about sort of hubris and science kind of science run amok. I mean, what I do think it illustrates is, you know, I don't know if people necessarily remember, but Frankenstein was this young student who kind of in a fever kind of decided to create a body by sewing together bits of cadavers that he'd dug out of, that he'd stolen from graves, and then electrified it with electricity, and it came to life. And then he was so freaked out by what he'd made that he ran off and abandoned it, and it went out into the world and caused havoc because it was lonely and sad. So one of the things that I take from there a little bit is that, like, Frankenstein was this young guy working in secret without oversight, without people sort of looking at his work and helping him think through the possible consequences in the future. So if there's one thing I'd like to take from that story, it's that doing something in secret is a bad idea because you don't benefit from the wisdom of all the people who can look at it in a different light and sort of say, hey, you know, what have you thought about what might happen if this escapes? So, that does come up a little bit. But I also, you know, the other thing about Mary Shelley is she was actually very, really fascinated by science. She was a lover of science and really excited about it. So I think she also was hoping that, that you know, we would embrace science and do science well, as well as sort of making up a horror story about science gone wrong.
Now, with gene editing, even just going back to the twins in China for a moment, their genes have been edited. So to some extent, are they not really, shall we say, the children of their parents anymore because they don't have the same genes?
Well, I wouldn't say that. They're definitely the children of their parents in sort of every sense, I think, even the biological sense. Something that people maybe don't know is that every time an embryo is made, the process of creating, you know, fertilization, there can actually be new kinds of genetic changes introduced in that process. So my genes may actually be slightly different from my parents' genes. There can be new mutations that occur just in the process of creating a new cell and a new being. And those are called de novo mutations. So the fact that they have these slight genetic differences from their biological parents doesn't by itself really tell us that that's any kind of different relationship. One of the things I think that is a little bit alarming about that study is that it's not really clear the parents fully understood what they were agreeing to. Mm. And that does seem like a really important problem with the study.
Yeah, because it would be one thing if... Is at this point for science, is there a point at which they have to have done the gene editing? Is there a point at which, say, just throwing out a number, second month of pregnancy, they can't really do anything after that because the development is too far along?
So it really depends on what kind of change you would be wanting to make. So if you would like to see the genetic change in every single cell in the body, then you would need to do it right at the beginning when you have just a single cell organism or very few cells, like right when the very earliest stages of the embryo, with the kind of embryos that you know, you create in IVF processes in the lab, so very early embryos, if you want to get it in every single cell. If, however, you wanted to see a genetic change only in certain cell types, or if it would be all right, if it would actually be effective, for instance, to just change, say, 10% of the genes in somebody's body, then you could maybe do that later in life. So the people who are in genetic gene editing trials now, who are adults, who are in studies, you know, they're just looking to change one type of cell in their body so they can maybe can, like, say if it's blood cells, you can do a transfusion and change those cells. So it really depends what you're trying to do, when in the process of human development you would want to try to make the change.
So if a woman is pregnant and they do some of the tests they can do now and they find out that there is, say, a very good chance that the child will be born with Down syndrome, is the possibility there that they can edit the genes to at least decrease the chance?
Well, so Down syndrome is caused by having an additional chromosome, which is much, much more than just having some different genes. It's a whole new, another chromosome. So that wouldn't be a candidate for gene editing, but something like cystic fibrosis or hemophilia, which are caused by single gene mutations, there is some early research in animals that is looking into the hypothesis that you could make in utero changes. So you could do in utero interventions where just some percentage of the fetus's cells could be changed, and instead of having hemophilia, you would just maybe be someone who bruised easily, and instead of having cystic fibrosis, you might just have, like, a little bit more chest infections but not really have the condition. So those are two examples of, like, I know there's some research going on to see if you could do, and you could do prenatal testing when someone's already pregnant, if you knew that the fetus had those genes, there might, you know, one day in the future be an intervention that you could do that would change some of the genes in the bodies of those fetuses so that ultimately the person who was born wouldn't have the genetic condition or would have a very mild version of it. So that research is ongoing, as well as research to look at doing this kind of thing in children and adults who are already exist and have a genetic condition like sickle cell or there's another syndrome that's in study right now, Huntington's disease, you know, these single gene disorders.
So are there some who argue that even if you know that there's a chance that a child is going to be born with sickle cell anemia or Huntington's disease, is there some argument that says it's better to wait until they're born and make sure that they do have the condition before you start thinking about editing the genes?
Sure. So anytime you are doing something in utero, you're doing it without as much information as you would have if you actually had a born child. I think some of the different debates here are going to end, you know, if these things ever show promise, is to be about, you know, what are the advantages of intervening earlier, what are the risks of intervening early, and how to weigh those risks and benefits. So that's definitely, like, one of the factors that you would want to take into account. And so, certainly if there was no benefit, if it was not a whole, you know, it has to be a whole lot better to do it in utero over being overweighting in order to do it, because even anything done in utero has always got various other additional risks, including, you know, the risk that you would do something that would somehow trigger the pregnancy to be lost. So, you know, in utero is like one of the most high-stakes environments you could possibly have, and certainly you would want very strong, compelling reasons to try to do anything in that context. But it may be that, you know, for some conditions, that might be the optimal time to intervene, but you'd have to weigh that against all the kind of risks associated with doing it and whether it might be better to wait.
Okay, so Josephine, the book is called Humans Flourishing in an Age of Gene Editing. You are the co-author of it. How can people get the book?
Well, it's on Amazon, or you can buy it from Oxford University Press. I should say that the book is an edited collection, so my co-editor and I commissioned people who think about this question of how to use science and technology well to write about gene editing. And so there are lots of very interesting and diverse group of people who have written essays that are in this book. And it's an interesting question because gene editing is really just the latest tool of a range of different tools that seem to promise that by having more control over our genes or the genes of our children, that we could actually live better. And when this book kind of asks, you know, is that really necessarily the case? And what are the different ways, you know, what are some other ways of thinking about it? So it's a diverse group of people thinking hard about what it means to live well with technology.
Josephine Johnson, thank you very much for calling in and talking to us today on Health First.
Thank you so much for having me. I wish I could be there in person in beautiful British Columbia.
Hey, thank you. That'll wrap it up for today's show. Have a happy and healthful week.